Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the suspension of trading on the Chinese stock market and the effect that uncertainties over the Chinese economy, along with increasing tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran and falling oil prices, are having as global markets and Wall Street took a hammering today, with the Dow down 392 points, its biggest loss in 3 months. First, we'll go to China and speak with Scott Kennedy, the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and the Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the author of Beyond the Middle Kingdom and the forthcoming book, The Dragon's Learning Curve, Global Governance in China. We will discuss China's dilemma in wanting more participation in the global economy, but at the same time not wanting to be subject to the kind of market forces that brought about the 2008 crash. Then we'll hear from Victor Shi, a professor of political science in the 21st Century China program in the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He joins us to discuss the more important issue than China's stock market, the decline of China's currency, the renminbi, which is at its lowest point in 6 years, and whether currency depreciation is being used to stimulate growth as currency weakness, economic slowdown and stock market turmoil combine to question how much the Chinese government is in control. Then finally, we will go to Flint, Michigan, to speak with Lonnie Scott, the Executive Director of Progress Michigan, about the poisonous water from the contaminated Flint River that the citizens of Flint have been forced to drink over the past year because of austerity imposed on the city by the state's Republican governor, Rick Snyder. We will discuss the call by Flint's most famous resident, Michael Moore, that Governor Snyder resign and be placed under arrest by the FBI for poisoning children in the name of cutting costs. And joining us now from Beijing is Scott Kennedy, who's the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and the Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships, and is the author of The Business of Lobbying China and edited China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization. He's also written Beyond the Middle Kingdom, and his forthcoming book is The Dragon's Learning Curve, Global Governance in China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Kennedy.
Hey, good talking to you.
So you're on the ground there, Scott, and there's something of a meltdown happening. The stock market has been closed twice now, or suspended, I should say. Is there a sense of panic where you are?
I don't think in Beijing there's a sense of panic. I think there's a sense of consternation and frustration that folks in the markets tend not to believe them, that the economy is doing okay and there shouldn't be a big devaluation and the market shouldn't fall off. And two, that the measures that they've taken aren't working and aren't increasing confidence, but actually having the opposite effect.
But aren't the authorities caught in a bit of a bind because they've encouraged people to get into the market to put their savings, you know, they don't want capital flight, so they've encouraged people to put their money in the market. But on the other hand, they want to be a part of the international economy, so they are trying to open up the flow of capital in and out, and that's creating the very thing that they were trying to avoid, capital flight.
Sure. Well, I think there's two things going on. There is the Chinese stock market problem, which are about the market not believing that growth is going to pick up, and that's leading folks to be quite concerned about the value of their stocks on the market, which they'd have been encouraged to get back into after last summer's gyrations. The other is which is a bigger problem for the global economy, is where the renminbi is heading and the fight that the Chinese officials are engaged in with global investors in foreign exchange.
And where would you say that is heading? Because it's obviously been a contentious issue for some time.
Sure. Well, the Chinese I believe that because their economy is likely to continue to grow at a relatively rapid rate with low inflation over the next decade or so, even if it grows more slowly than it had been, that's from the fundamental perspective, a reason for a relatively strong renminbi. And so they don't believe that over the long term, the renminbi should depreciate. But there's a difference between the long term and the short term. And they are having a very difficult time grappling with the type of volatility that comes with a global foreign exchange market that they can't dominate. And that's particularly highlighted by the existence of trading in the renminbi outside China, which really shows what the global economy thinks about the rate, which is, you know, lower than what the rate is in markets in China. So that's the struggle, and the Chinese are having a difficult time coming to grips with the possibility that they may need to allow a larger depreciation than they wanted to originally.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Kennedy, who is in Beijing. He's the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships, and is the author of The Business of Lobbying in China and edited China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization. His most recent book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom, and his forthcoming book is The Dragon's Learning Curve, Global Governance in China. But it seems that you can't have it both ways. If you join the global economy, you more or less have to have a market economy. And so far, the Chinese have tried to contain or guide their economy through massive sort of infrastructure projects and building, a lot of which is overbuilt, and a lot of local government debt as a result. Where would you say they are in terms of dealing with this dilemma of the global versus the domestic?
Yeah. The Chinese have a record of 36 years of relatively rapid growth, longer, faster than anyone else on record, using a strategy of significant government intervention in different markets, products, regions, that has brought them a lot of success. It's generated troubles, but they've been able to overcome each of those growing pains along the way. And so they aren't, they look at countries in Latin America and others that have felt the winds of foreign exchange wars and debt crises, and they want to avoid that at all costs. And so they're having a difficult, they believe that if they gave in to currency traders and those who expect the renminbi to continue to depreciate, that would be surrendering and them giving up the ability to control their own destiny. And so they know in their heart of hearts that a market economy, a more market-oriented economy, is important going forward, because you can't use the old heavy investment strategy when what you need to do is innovate to grow. But that transition going from one to the other, that's the longest step they've ever had to take. You know, China talks about reform as feeling the stones to cross the river. That next stone, it's not just a small step away, it's a big leap away, and there's a lot of dangerous waters in between that they're quite, and so they're really worried about that, and that's what's happening right now.
But you can hardly blame the Chinese for wanting to steer clear of the kind of market insanity, if you will, that brought about the 2008 crash. You know, is it possible that they could, in joining the global economy more, could be a more rational force as opposed to the irrational exuberance, to quote the former chairman of the Fed, Alan Greenspan, that brought about the 2008 crash?
Sure. Sure. You know, as the Chinese become more involved in global economic regimes, you know, this year they're hosting the G20 process. There's a good reason that folks have talked about needs to kind of take steps to reduce global volatility. And certainly the Chinese are living through the challenges of that right now, as are many others. But that's a long-term conversation, and it's certainly going to come up in the G20 this year and in Chinese bilateral conversations with the trading partners, and we're going to see it every day play out in markets. But in the short term today, you know, if the Chinese continue to fight against markets, they're going to be fighting against windmills, and they're going to be spending a lot of money. One, they're spending money to keep the renminbi from depreciating faster by intervening in foreign exchange markets. And two, there's some capital flight for China. Both of those things are contractionary, and they're working against China's goal of trying to get the economy to grow, because you need an expansionary economic environment for growth. And so they're really you know, fighting with each, you know, internally the struggle, and that's a problem that they're going to have to come to terms with. And again, that it's very uncomfortable for them to do so, given that their history is one of being in control and being able to guide their own fate.
Well, but, you know, in this country, we have, you know, given what happened in 2008 and the continuing domination of our economy by the financial sector, it's growing, I think it's past 60% of the economy now, is dominated essentially by Wall Street. There is, I think, a valid question there about, you know, whether our economy is dominated by those that are interested in extracting wealth as opposed to creating wealth. And where would you say the Chinese leadership are in terms? Are they, is that what they're trying to avoid? I mean, they do, you know, 60 Minutes did some pieces on vast, overbuilt suburbs with huge malls with not a soul in sight. So there are some contradictions, but in general, they do things. They build infrastructure. Our infrastructure is, you know, we've had record low interest rates now for over a decade, and no investment's been made in infrastructure because of our political gridlock. So, you know, the more I talk about China, the more I have to pull back and say, well, we're not exactly the great example.
I think that's, you know, helpful to understand that, you know, in that there aren't, that the United States economy is far from perfect, that we have our own challenges. We certainly see that from the different perspectives of the candidates who are running for president. And, you know, we just need to look back to 2008 and 9 to remember that we have a lot to do ourselves. China's economic situation is quite different. Their stock market and securities markets occupy a very small percentage of their economy and are not the driving force behind their economy. And in fact, it isn't really theoretically possible, but if China's stock market dropped to zero, it would affect a few people's pocketbooks. There'd be some serious protests, but it wouldn't be the end of China's economy because it's such a small percentage of the overall financial system. China's still primarily a bank-dominated financial system, and I think to let the stock market control the direction of what Chinese policymakers are thinking about is letting the tail wag the dog. And really what they need to do is pay attention to their basic economic fundamentals, which I think you already pointed out. And the bigger problem today really isn't the stock market. I don't think that we should be over-focused on that. It's really where the renminbi is heading. That is a very serious contest. It has much bigger implications for China's economy and also for others that trade with China, that invest in China, because that has real potential dangers for the global economy.
So you mentioned the political presidential race here in the United States. How do the Chinese see the lineup there, with particularly with Donald Trump dominating the Republican side? The notion of a Chinese real estate billionaire running China is a scary idea, at least to my mind.
Yeah, well, as some Western media have reported, Chinese leaders don't necessarily lack wealth themselves. But I think they look at these slate of candidates, and none of them leave them either highly impressed or highly confident that the U.S. will manage its place in the world or the bilateral relationship appropriately. I think, you know, they know Hillary Clinton and her policies pretty well. I think they also have a general level of comfort with Jeb Bush, given his family and some other experiences they've had with him directly. Everyone else is a huge question mark, and they only know about them through what they see on the campaign trail. And I think for them, they're as worried as many Americans are about what to expect from these various candidates. At the same time, they also know that this is a campaign season, and you know the Chinese are cynical and skeptical about democracy for a reason, and you know, so they take what the candidates say with a grain of salt.
Well, it's hard to know. When you say they're skeptical of democracy, they obviously, Tiananmen showed that there was a real yearning and for democracy, but that was so brutally put down. And then the leadership encouraged a form of nationalism amongst the young. So And that's clearly had an effect. But are the Chinese, given how much they're into consumer goods that, you know, after all, the iPhone is an American product made in China, but they seem to be incredibly integrated into social media and very, you know, savvy. They've got all of the name brands, consumer goods, luxury brands included. You get the impression that they certainly want to be a part of the West. So how do you divide the economic from the political? I know that that's what the authorities have essentially done, but will that last forever?
Sure, sure. Yeah, well, I mean, what I was just describing was certainly the official view about the American political system and Western political systems in general. Within China, there's a great diversity of opinions, probably within the government and even within the Communist Party and within the public at large. With 1.4 billion people, you're going to have a diverse range of opinions. And I've met people in China who believe that the current political system in China must evolve and adapt to be much more flexible and to accommodate the modernization and globalization, that it's very difficult for this type of system to manage. And you know, to some extent, we're seeing that in the context of the market problems that we're facing now. Of course, you know, Chinese officials would say if they were just following the whim of voters right now, the policy would be pulled left and right in many different directions, and they couldn't have a consistent policy. So from the leadership's perspective, they believe that this continued intervention and trying to maintain the renminbi from falling off a cliff is a sign of their consistency, and people should see that resolve in positive terms. But it's certainly a struggle, and we're getting to see this socialization process and the challenge play out as the market ticks up and as it ticks down.
But just in closing, is there much of a push within the country for more freedom of expression? It seems to be kind of concurrent with social media, etc. You know, I know they have zillions of censors. They have, what do they call them, the 50 cents cadre.
Yes.
People who...
50 cent army, yeah.
Yeah, who are paid 50 cents to say nice things about the government over the internet. I can't see that going on forever.
You know, China's awash in contradictions, or as the Chinese would say, different forces that balance each other out. Certainly, you'll find a huge, vast social media where there's a lot of vibrant discussion. People's tastes are quite varied. Art is quite diverse, and at the same time, the Chinese authorities are very worried about losing control. That's something which is at the core of how they view their role. There was a recent former Chinese leader, Chen Yun, who talked about managing the economy like you would as a bird in a bird cage. You try to make the cage large enough to provide plenty of room for that bird to be able to fly around and feel comfortable, but you still need the cage. That metaphor applies not just to China's economy, but could apply to the rest of Chinese life and the way the authorities think about things. They want to make the cage bigger. They want to make it prettier. They want to make it more comfortable for the bird, but they're not willing to fully open up that door because of the forces that they think will be unleashed by that.
Well, Scott Kennedy, I very much appreciate you joining us here today from Beijing.
Good chatting with you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Kennedy, who's a Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He is the author of The Business of Lobbying in China and edited China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization. His most recent book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom, and his forthcoming book is The Dragon's Learning Curve, Global Governance in China. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with a second opinion on what is causing turmoil in China's stock market and its currency to decline. Thank you.
world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Victor Shi, who's Professor of Political Science in the 21st Century China Program at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He has published widely on the politics of Chinese banking policies, fiscal policies, and exchange rates, and was the first analyst to identify the risk of massive local government debt. He is currently engaged in a study of how the coalition formation strategies of founding leaders had a profound impact on the evolution of the Chinese Communist Party, as well as constructing a large database on biographical information of the elites in China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Victor Shi.
Thank you for having me on, Ian.
And there's a lot of focus, of course, on suspending trading for the second time on the Chinese stock exchange. And, of course, there's clearly been an impact here in terms of the markets, both here in the United States and around the world. There are other factors at play. Of course, the increasing tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran, the North Korean nuclear test, etc. But this does seem to be rippling a bit, but we just spoke a minute ago with Scott Kennedy in Beijing, and he says that the real issue is the renminbi. Would you agree with that, that's where the real vulnerability is?
I think I would agree that that is a much larger issue than the domestic stock sell-off, because many fewer foreign investors are certainly involved in the domestic stock market in China, whereas the currency, the renminbi, if it were to devalue in a significant way, it would affect asset prices, across a broad swath around the world.
But, of course, a weaker renminbi helps exporters and therefore stimulates growth. But it seems to have, and it's been in a slow decline, and the rate now is at 6.5646 to the dollar, which is the lowest point in almost 6 years. But it also seems to have the collateral damage seems to be that this forces companies and individuals to send money out of the country at a rapid rate.
Right. So I think the thing about the renminbi one has to bear in mind is that the exchange rate was very, very stable, and it changed very, very little, over time for a very, very long time. Basically, the entire market was expecting very little volatility in the currency. And among EM countries, investors thought that the renminbi was one of the most stable currencies, among emerging market countries. The fact that seems to be changing, I think, is a very big factor for investors around the world. So they can no longer count on this one very stable emerging market currency, and the renminbi looks like it's going to be changing more. To be sure, I think the Chinese leadership is still trying to have a relatively stable currency, but increasingly that is getting difficult. One of the key issues is that the Federal Reserve is hiking interest rates, which, of course, affects all EM economies, not just China. But China is one of the very few emerging market economies that's trying to cut interest rates right now as a way to deal with its enormous pile of debt. Non-financial credit as a share of GDP in China is the highest among emerging market countries. And I think it's just slightly lower than the level in Europe right now. It's at, nearly 250% of GDP. Some would say, some like myself, so that's a consensus figure, but I would say that it's actually closer to 300% of GDP. In any event, if China had high interest rates, it obviously is not very sustainable because interest payments would be, 20, 30% of GDP. So they're trying to cut interest rates. But it's very difficult to do when the Federal Reserve is hiking interest rates. Rational investors who now control a lot of money in China would want to move the money out of China. So
So I think that is certainly, we're talking about a lot more potential movement of money there in the currency market than in the stock market. Although, of course, I agree that the optics of the stock sell-off and the circuit breaker is very bad, you know, for a country which announced again and again in the past 2 years that it would allow market forces to play a, quote, decisive role in determining prices in the economy. They're clearly going against that announcement.
But the problem with this dynamic of where the weaker the renminbi gets, the more selling there will be, this leads people to question how much the government is in control. How much of that is real and how much of that is panic?
I think in the currency market, that is one market where the Chinese government and the ruling Chinese Communist Party really doesn't have complete control over, because, you know, the price of, you know, U.S. interest rates, obviously dollar interest rates, clearly not controlled by China, it's controlled by the Federal Reserve. And all China can do is to prevent money from flowing out of China. So, you know, they haven't implemented new capital control measures. They will continue to do more, but that's going to take a very heavy toll on the economy. China is a trading economy. You know, it conducts trillions of dollars in trade every year. And if capital control was too draconian, it's going to hurt China's trade. So I think, you know, the Chinese government can maintain some facade of having total control, but the cost is going to be increasingly expensive for the Chinese government.
And again, I'm speaking with Victor Shi. He's a professor of political science in the 21st Century China program at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He has published widely on the politics of Chinese banking policies, fiscal policies, and exchange rates, and was the first analyst to identify the risk of massive local government debt. He is currently engaged in a study of how the coalition formation strategies of founding leaders had a profound impact on the evolution of the Chinese Communist Party, as well as constructing a large database on biographic information of China's elites. So just to pull back a bit, Victor, and put this in the context of the global financial system, I mentioned tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia and obviously falling oil prices, and they're continuing to fall, and that's the general sense that China is slowing down. And on top of that, you have the suspension of trading on the markets, etc., that clearly roil the markets. But the billionaire investor George Soros, speaking at an economic forum in Sri Lanka, he drew parallels between the present economic global economic environment and the financial crash of 2008. And he said that global markets are facing a crisis and investors need to be very cautious. So what do you think he's talking about?
Well, I think, you know, the challenges facing the entire emerging market is quite large. I think the basic fundamental problem is that the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Federal Reserve, created very cheap dollars starting in 2008 when the U.S. was dealing with its own financial crisis. And of course, much of that money did not stay in the U.S. A lot of it flowed to emerging market countries, where the returns are higher. But many of these economies are not, you know, fully functioning market economies. And the biggest case of that, of course, is China. So a lot of this money flowed into China, you know, through trade surplus or just through hot money inflow. So a lot of speculators were arbitraging the difference in interest rates between China and the U.S., and bringing basically cheap U.S. capital into China. But because China was not and still is not a well-functioning market economy, a lot of the money ended up in government-controlled hands and invested in a very inefficient way. So the returns that these investments generated was quite low and in some cases zero or even negative. So now that capital is starting, the dollar capital at least, is starting to become dear again, the investors who wasted all of this cheap capital are now scrambling around to repay a lot of the debt that they have borrowed over the past few years. And that is creating basically problem across the entire emerging market. So I think while the U.S. seems to me, at least I'm not a U.S. expert, to be fine, or at least not as, you know, bad as some of the other countries, many countries in the emerging market, especially commodities exporters, and also China, are facing, could be facing a pretty painful adjustment period ahead.
Well, that strikes me, though, as so ironic when you say that there was, dollars looking for some place to park. And here we have in the United States, up until very recently, we've had the lowest interest rates. We've had extremely low, 0.25% interest rates now for about a decade at least. And this would have been a propitious time to invest in America's crumbling infrastructure. China, of course, has invested enormously in infrastructure. And you're saying they used the cheap dollars and spent them on stuff that may not necessarily be profitable. But it seems to be the...
Well, so you have identified the problem. You have identified the problem. So what China was doing is that even though a lot of this infrastructure, the real return on the infrastructure is zero or very low or negative, the state banking system in China intermediated that by offering high interest rates to people. So deposit interest rate, which now is fairly low in China, 1.5%, was for a very long time, 3-4%. And so you could get basically free money in dollars, get it into China, get 4% in the state banking system. And then the state banks would lend that money to projects, which at the end of the day yielded basically no return. Right.
Right. But contrast that to the United States, which needs the investment in infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And because it has a broken political system, they couldn't, do infrastructure programs except for the one emergency one that Obama got through after the TARP, after the crash in 2008. I just find the contrast extraordinary that, in effect, America invested in China but not in America.
Yeah. I mean, it is somewhat ironic, but having said that, China is able to do a lot of infrastructure projects, partly because they have no property rights. So they can, basically everything is eminent domain. They can go to any village, any neighborhood to tear down the entire neighborhood, within the space of a few months. That obviously is a very long legal process in the United States, even when it comes to eminent domain. I'm not sure that people in the U.S. would like the Chinese system. I think having some property rights is a good thing.
Yeah, but having high-speed trains is not a bad thing. I mean, we're in a terrible shape in terms of our rail system. It's just absolutely crumbling. Airports are maxed out. I know this is another subject, but I think there's no question about the fact that we've missed the boat here in terms of a great opportunity to do infrastructure projects. But we obviously don't have the same political system, or we have a broken political system, I think is more to the point. I asked Scott this question, but I'd love to get your opinion on it, since you're creating a database on biographical information on China's elites. How do they view what's happening in the United States? I mentioned broken government. It's no secret that Washington's basically paralyzed, and you've got this bizarre political year coming up that's just started, and you've got, the idea of a Chinese real estate billionaire running for, they have elections there, but becoming the leader of China is a scary prospect. But how do they see Donald Trump and all these candidates running for president?
I don't know how they feel about the individual candidates, but I think the current leadership of in China grew up during the Cultural Revolution, which was the most radical period of Maoist thinking. And I think that where, of course, during the Mao period, the United States was the absolute enemy and, so on and so forth. There's still a very high degree, I would say, of paranoia in the Chinese leadership when they think about, America's intention vis-a-vis China. There is a very common belief, which is very worrisome, that war between China and America is inevitable or difficult to avoid in any case. and that, you know, this is why China needs to strengthen itself as quickly as possible and expand its international influence as much as possible. So there is a very kind of this, it was almost, I would almost say 19th century, you know, great power politics kind of mentality among the Chinese leadership. And I think, you know, for the United States, for whoever, you know, becomes the next president of the United States, that's very worrisome because, you know, I think the United States, at least in the past 10 or so years, have tried to move a little bit away from that kind of model of international politics toward more multilateralism, toward relying more on international institutions. And it's unclear that, you know, China would play that game along with the United States.
Well, but these same leaders in China that may have these sort of paranoid and antiquated views, they nevertheless are sending their kids to be educated over here and buying property over here, etc. So there's a bit of a contradiction there, wouldn't you say?
Well, they're trying to rein that in a little bit. I think for higher-level officials, their children can no longer study overseas. Mm-hmm. I don't know about the ones who are overseas already. Haven't heard that they've been recalled, but I think that's a distinct possibility that some of them may be called back to China. I mean, certainly there's a very concerted effort to go after supposedly corrupt officials who have escaped overseas, and China is in a very systematic effort to capture these people overseas and bring them back to China for trial.
So just in closing then, so these disputes over these manufactured islands in the South China Sea, if what you're telling us is correct, then this is worrisome, these tensions, right?
Yeah, it is. I think there's very little scope for compromise for China on the South China Sea. I think it also this was probably where we got here. I think, in my opinion, at least, it's kind of a mistake by the U.S. government, right? I think the U.S. did not challenge the construction of these islands until very late in the game when the runway is almost finished, right? So I think the U.S. should have been doing freedom of navigation operations around these islands all along and, you know, maybe try some way to disrupt the construction of these islands. Now that they're done, they've become facts on the ground, and China, I think, will take a pretty hard stand on, you know, maintaining these islands, artificial islands.
Well, Victor Shi, I thank you very much for joining us here. I appreciate it.
Yep, thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Victor Shi, who's a professor of political science in the 21st Century China program in the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He's published widely on the politics of Chinese banking policies, fiscal policies and exchange rates, and was the first analyst to identify the risk of massive local government debt. He's currently engaged in a study on how the coalition formation strategies of founding leaders had a profound impact on the evolution of the Chinese Communist Party, as well as constructing a large database on biographical information of China's elites. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about how the children in Flint, Michigan are being poisoned in the name of cutting costs.
What's happened to the water? Our water's going bare. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by man. Poison floating out to sea now threatens life on.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lonnie Scott, who's Executive Director of Progress Michigan. He has extensive legislative advocacy and nonprofit and public policy experience in Michigan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lonnie Scott.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be here.
And your fellow Michigander, Michael Moore, has basically called for the FBI to arrest Governor Schneider, and at the same time calling for him in an open letter to resign. Dear Governor Schneider, you have to go to jail. This is the open letter. Any word back from the governor on that one?
Not that I've heard at all, Ian, but, it's been a pretty rough couple of days for the governor since they finally started to take responsibility a little bit for what's happening. And certainly, more and more keeps coming to light. So I haven't heard anything specifically in response to that letter yet.
But meanwhile, this story has been going on for some time. You know, Rachel Maddow at MSNBC is one of the few people who've been reporting on it. It's taken a while for the general public in the country to wake up. I mean, the idea that you have to drink water out of a local river that's polluted should get people's attention, surely.
Yeah. This is something that local groups here in Michigan have been trying to shine a light on for quite a while. You know, if you go back into the records that are coming forward now, this has been a problem for about a year and a half. And residents started complaining almost immediately that there was something wrong. We didn't know until relatively recently, 6 months or so ago, that it was actual lead poisoning that was taking place. Although there were indicators that had not been made public that were happening, at the government level. I'm glad that there is now attention being paid to this nationally and everywhere, because it's an absolute disgrace that the government essentially knew that they were poisoning people and failed to act to help the children and families in Flint.
So let's go back a bit to what the governor did and brought about this crisis in the first place, forcing the residents of Flint, Michigan, to get water from the Flint River, which is very contaminated.
Yeah, so Ian, Governor Snyder, along with the Republican legislature here in Michigan, passed a law that was changes to the emergency manager law. And that's where all of this actually goes back to. So essentially, it allows the governor in financially distressed cities or school districts to insert an unelected, really unaccountable to anyone but the governor, bureaucrat to run whatever the entity is that they're taking over. So in this case, it was the city of Flint. And after being appointed, that person has the ultimate power. They take all of the power from any elected officials in that area. So the mayor, the city council, none of those folks have any kind of power over decisions that are being made in those municipalities or school districts. And the governor has used this this approach in several cities. Most of the time, it's in minority-majority cities like Flint and Detroit, Benton Harbor, that have been given these emergency managers. And so in Flint, there was an emergency manager, and the decision was made to switch the water to a new source that would have been safe. But there was a time period that wasn't going to be available. And rather than stay connected to the Detroit City water, that is when the decision was made, the emergency manager, to switch the water to the Flint River as the source of water for the people of the city of Flint. And once that decision was made, there was also a lack of preparation for that switch. I'm no scientist or anyone who knows about the corrosion, but from what I've gathered and what has been reported is that when you change a water source, you have to take certain precautions because there's going to be lead and those kinds of things in the pipes. But usually there's an anti-contaminant that is added to the water to prevent any leaching of those bad contaminants. And when the switch was made, there were not proper precautions taken. And essentially what we've ended up with is water that has been lead poisoning an entire community for quite some time.
And again, I'm speaking with Lonnie Scott, who's Executive Director of Progress Michigan. He has extensive legislative advocacy, nonprofit, and public policy experience in Michigan. And we're talking about the citizens of Flint, Michigan, having to get their water from the Flint River, which is quite contaminated. And this has been going on, how long did you say? Over a year and about a year and a half?
Yeah, I believe so. I'd have to look up the exact dates, but quite some time.
Well, now the mechanism by which the governor, who my understanding is one of these kind of Republican ideologues like Governor Brownback in Kansas, who really believe in their free market fundamentalism, which of course has led to a catastrophe in Kansas, you know, by cutting taxes for the wealthy. There's no revenues coming in. I know Snyder's apparently in that kind of mold, but appointing these local czars that are answerable only to the governor and don't represent the people in the localities that they've taken over, isn't that exactly what the governor did with Detroit itself? In effect, many have argued that he forced the city into bankruptcy.
That's exactly right. And you know, it goes deeper than that too, Ian. I mean, part of the problem is that the Republicans that have controlled the legislature, they also have cut any kind of funding and, you know, the support systems for the cities as well. So, you know, first of all, they helped send them into a spiral or continue the downward spiral coming out of the economic downturn that everyone experienced across the country. And then our governor put in these emergency managers that are, you know, unelected bureaucrats that are accountable to no one but the governor. And that's exactly what happened. They pushed Detroit into bankruptcy. You know, they're able to come into a community and totally dismantle contracts. It's another method that they've used to break up unions in a lot of areas, because they can go in and dismantle all those contracts. And you know, the real interesting thing with Governor Snyder is when he came to Michigan and was elected as governor, he was elected as a businessman nerd is the persona that he put out there. And it's become almost, you know, a horrible dream, you know, a nightmare of the reality of what he is. He is nowhere near moderate. The decisions that he makes are nowhere near as calculated as what you would think of as a nerd. And he certainly is treating the state as a businessman in that the decisions are made based on a bottom line. You know, he frequently calls the citizens of Michigan customers. You know, that's the type of approach that they're taking. And in Flint, you know, the decisions were made to make this switch to the Flint River to save money. And essentially what they have done is they have ruined the lives of generations of children in Flint, because lead poisoning is irreversible. And it was all done based on the almighty dollar.
Well, but my understanding is that it's not just that the governor is a sort of businessman, and you mentioned he doesn't see the residents of his state as citizens, but more as customers. But also, isn't this really about the pettiest form of politics in this country in terms of the polarization between Democrats and Republicans, that you have the Republicans who dominate the legislature and the governor being a Republican? They basically come from rural Michigan, and the people who are getting hosed, both in Detroit and Flint, urban Michigan, which tends to vote Democrat, and that there's a undeniable petty partisan characteristic to this.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we see that across the state. You know, one of the things that I always say, and I believe it's totally true, is that for 30 years, you know, for decades, the Republicans have told us that government is broken. And then when they get control, they actually govern to prove it. And that's exactly, you know, what we're seeing here. And certainly it is. I don't believe that if this had happened in an affluent white city or a suburb where, you know, where Republicans predominantly control, that this would have been able to go on as long as it did. But because Flint is a poor minority community, they didn't focus on it. They didn't fix it as quickly as they should have. And I believe now, just as things are being uncovered, they're acting as if, you know, they really are concerned. When in, you know, as these emails come out, there was one that just came out today where one of Snyder's top officials, his chief of staff, said that he felt that they were blowing off the people of Flint over their concerns that the administration was doing that. And so, you know, I think it's you are absolutely correct. It is the worst type of politics. And it is, really damaging a community in our state.
So just to get into the specifics of the governor's culpability here, if his chief of staff's saying you're ignoring the concerns, I take it that, you know, you can't not notice poisonous water if you drink it. It usually smells bad. So I imagine for a year and a half now, the people have been saying we can't drink the water, right?
Yeah, they almost immediately upon switching to the Flint River, that the residents of Flint started complaining. I mean, the water was brown. It smelled funny. There were people who were losing their hair or coming up with skin lesions. Children who, you know, I've seen stories that have been reported on the news, children who were waking up in the middle of the night complaining that their bones hurt. Parents who knew that there was something wrong. I think one of the, you know, I'm a parent. I have two kids. One of the most heart-wrenching stories I've read is a parent who told her sons just to take small sips. I mean, this is a horrendous act. And certainly the information that came out today was that the chief of staff knew back in July or was saying back in July that they felt like they were blowing off the residents of Flint. You know, this has been allowed to continue and really no response as they've tried to quietly cover it up. I mean, the thing that a lot of people aren't talking about either, we know that the governor's office, before all of this news broke, was actually quietly using private foundations or groups to quietly try and pass out some water filters to the people of Flint. So I do believe that they knew there was a problem. We know that people came forward and complained. We know that you know, there were researchers from Virginia Tech. They've been working on this. Certainly the ACLU of Michigan has been a leader in bringing this to the forefront, and that people have been speaking out about it for quite a while. And it isn't until now, as documents start to be released, because Michigan also has a very broken FOIA system that exempts our governor from the Freedom of Information Act. But just now, as documents are starting to be released and come forward, we're seeing the true extent and how high in the administration it goes.
But I'm not sure, and I'm sure our listeners aren't sure either, why this happened in the first place. You say that the city was getting its water from Detroit. And did the governor and his manager that he appointed, the czar, decide that that was too expensive? Or what was the motive to cut them off from the supply that they'd been getting to have them drink out of this poisonous river?
Yeah, there was a new supply that was going to be a cheaper option that just wasn't fully operational until 2016. And so the real problem became that in the interim, instead of sticking with the option that they had, staying connected to the Detroit water system, that's when they opted to save. I believe that the estimate that they were going to save was $15 million a year to go to this to just switch to using the Flint River as their system. And so it really was. It was about saving money at that point.
Yeah, but $15 million compared to the health of the residents. How many people and how many children do you think are being affected by this? And what, I mean, just off the top of my head, it would seem to me that the medical costs alone would be greater than $15 million, let alone the permanent damage to the health of the citizens.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. And that's what no one, you know, it's hard for me to understand. But again, you know, I come from this at a perspective as I'm always trying to look for what's best. And I believe that government should be looking for what's best for the residents. And that is clearly not the mindset that has taken over Michigan with the governor and the Republican legislature. They're looking out for the bottom line. And so, you know, it is money and moneyed interest that take priority. And so, you know, you asked how many people. I think it's thousands of children in Flint who are potentially have been exposed and are going to have issues. And that doesn't include, you know, any adults or other folks that we may be talking about that have already been experiencing issues. So it is going to cost the state. You know, I believe that there needs to be and we welcome the DOJ probe. I think that there should be a criminal and civil probe, and it's certainly going to cost the state more than they expected to save. And I think it's a perfect example of trying to be penny wise but being pound foolish. I mean, I think that this, you know, you can't operate the state like a business. And at some point, people's lives have to be more important than a bottom line. And certainly Flint, unfortunately, at this point, is a stark reminder of that.
Well, but it doesn't even sound like there, in term, when you say the bottom line, Lonnie, it does. It seems to me that the bottom line is not about, you know, some greedy capitalist making an extra buck. This is just sort of punitive, ideologically driven callousness that they're just saving a few bucks. You know, this is austerity gone crazy, as far as I can see.
Yes. Yeah. And it's, and that's what the emergency managers are about. When I say the bottom line, when they put in an emergency manager, that's exactly the goal, is to cut costs and cut back any kind of services and cost of government that they can. And that's what I mean in this case. So, it, you know, we're saying very similar things, just with different words. You are absolutely correct.
So do you think Michael Moore is going to get his way, that the governor is going to end up in handcuffs, in an orange jumpsuit, being led on a perp walk by the FBI?
You know, I think it's hard to say. I think a few weeks ago it would have been plausible to say probably not, that maybe this didn't go as high as the governor, that it was just administrators, you know, at a level that was below him. But, you know, the revelation today that his chief of staff knew back in July, until the governor comes forward and releases all the documents, again, he has executive privilege to hide behind with our Freedom of Information Act, where he does not have to release direct documents. The governor and our legislature are both exempt. We're one of only two states that allow that. You know, I think that we need to know what he knew and when he knew it. And certainly that's why I say I hope that there is a criminal and civil probe, and that we welcome the Department of Justice coming in and checking this out. I mean, it's a horrible act that has happened. And the people of Flint definitely deserve justice.
Well, Lonnie Scott, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Lonnie Scott, who's Executive Director of Progress Michigan. He has extensive legislative advocacy, nonprofit, and public policy experience in Michigan. This is Beam Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another background briefing. Bye for now.